From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's get our bearings now on Hurricane Dorian, which is now a Category 2 storm, already flooding parts of the Carolinas. Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network in Gainesville, has been watching for a week there in Florida. And Jeff, we really appreciate your accurate information. This is such an ever-changing storm. People's nerves are on edge. What do you want us to know right now?
Well, yeah, good afternoon, Robin. And we provide that same service to our South Carolina public radio stations as well, and they are sure taking the brunt of it right now. Hurricane force winds reported in Charleston Harbor, and the eye wall is going to brush the coast, Georgetown up to Myrtle Beach, landfall potentially tonight just south of Wilmington as Hurricane Dorian continues to move north and east. It's important to remember that the hazards from Dorian will extend several hours after the eye wall passes, especially up in the PD region of South Carolina.
Jeff, I'm seeing pictures. There's a car on the beach with surf going over it in Myrtle Beach. We saw flooded streets with downed wires that were sparking. It's happening.
Yeah, it's a full hurricane capable of producing all the hazards you would traditionally get. We've had several tornado reports, even some very large tornadoes on those outer rain bands. So residents in North Carolina, the storm still may be several hundred miles to your south, but those rain bands are rotating and producing tornadoes. We have two active tornado warnings right now in North Carolina.
Okay. Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, in Dorian's rearview mirror, the Bahamas, particularly the Abaco Islands, which are decimated, so is Grand Bahama, where CNN's Patrick Ottman has been for a week doing terrific reporting. Patrick, what are your concerns?
I'm very concerned that since no food or water at this point has arrived, I mean, we're running low on food and water. And I'm just not saying that so people feel sorry for us. We chose to be here. But we're CNN, and we come very well supplied. I cover hurricanes a lot. I'm based in Havana in the Caribbean. For Bahamians, they don't have food and water. Some stores have opened to sell what little they have. I'm looking out in an ocean that's totally calm, and there are no boats. And I just don't understand at this point why the aid is not pouring in. And I know the Bahamas is overwhelmed and is a country with limited resources. But that doesn't matter when you have people that are on their last legs.
Do you think it's because the sense is that the Abaco Islands, you know, the pictures that we saw, which are maybe just coming out of Grand Bahama, you know, maybe as you said, it's just been diverted there.
I don't know. I'm very cut off from the rest of the world. The images out of the Grand Abacos are striking. I don't think we've seen the worst of the damage here yet, and that's part of my mission. You had a lot of media that had arrived in the last few days in the Grand Abacos. I'm pretty much it for outside media here. There's one AP photographer in the worst hit areas. We just have not been able to get to them. You know, I don't know why the help has not arrived here. I hope that's going to change.
Yeah.
It is needed here.
And Patrick, you can't leave. I mean, you were there before the storm came. Now you're trapped there. And we're the first to get to the airport in Freeport and found, what, total devastation?
Total devastation. Damage I have not seen in really any hurricane. There's a piece of a plane inside the terminal with the wing and the wheels still sticking out the side of that terminal. The other terminals, we couldn't get in because they haven't been open.
Yeah.
The runway was covered in debris, pieces of metal, pieces of concrete, and there needs to be an assessment done to see if planes carrying large amounts of aid can land on a runway that's been underwater for several days. They just don't know if it's structurally sound.
Meantime, we're hearing stories of one Freeport resident, Harold Williams, who went out with his son on a jet ski to try to rescue people. What are you seeing the people there try to do?
I saw those scenes, and I walked in some of that water that was full of sewage, and people came with their jet skis, the rowboats. I didn't see a single government boat. I didn't see a single police boat. These are private citizens. There are Bahamians here, and you ask the Bahamians, why are you out here on the front lines? And they say, it's the Bahamian way, and if we don't do it, no one does it. And that's a very admirable sentiment, but you can only fit one person, maybe two, on the back of a jet ski. That is not the vehicle you use to rescue people. And there's no sense of organization. There's no one directing this on a large scale. And I've talked to so many people that have missing relatives that went into their neighbors' homes to rescue them and saw that they had died. The death toll is going to rise here. I feel that's a certainty.
Does Grand Bahama have a hospital?
It does. I have not been able to reach that. It's on my to-do list today. When I tried to go the other day, the waters were still about 6 feet high. And just think, the highest piece of land is only 30 feet high. The storm surge was 20 feet high. The ocean came in from 2 miles away in certain points. You know, people say it's not as bad as the Abacos. I can't compare it to the Abacos. I just know it's bad.
Well, and you've just answered a question. If you couldn't get to the hospital, then people who are injured can't. That's CNN's Patrick Oppen doing terrific reporting throughout Dorian from Grand Bahama Island. Patrick, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Well, we are also following breaking news out of the United Kingdom. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he'd rather be dead in a ditch than delay Brexit. That message in a speech today after suffering another setback when his brother quit the government. Joe Johnson, who voted to remain in the European Union, resigned as a member of parliament and a minister in his brother's cabinet, which wants to take the UK out of the EU. Over the last 2 days, the prime minister has lost a series of votes. Lawmakers rejected leaving the EU without a deal, and also Johnson's call for a general election. But Johnson is not giving up on the idea of an election. He spoke today in the British town of Wakefield.
We either go forward with our plan to get a deal, take the country out on October the 31st, which we can, or else somebody else should be allowed to see if they can keep us in beyond October the 31st.
Joining us now is NPR's Frank Langfitt in London. And Frank, tell us more about what Johnson had to say today, which seemed odd given the events of the last couple of days.
You know, what he did today, actually, this was he was there to talk about the need for more police officers on the streets. But this quickly became basically the kickoff of his election campaign for this fall. And what he's basically saying is we need to go back to the people here in the United Kingdom and decide who is going to lead this country. And in his case, say lead the country out of the European Union as soon as possible and not have this continue to drag on and on and on.
But is there going to be an election in October if, as we just said, the lawmakers just rejected the idea of an election?
They did. But here's the strategy. I think there will be an election this fall. I think there's no doubt about that. The Labour Party has to go for an election. And Johnson no longer has a majority in Parliament. He can't get anything done. So we really have true paralysis here. And so I think what you're going to see is Johnson wanting the election earlier and Labour wanting it later. I think what they'd like to do is drag past that deadline of October 31st to make Johnson look bad and force him to go back to Brussels and ask for an extension and hope that that actually helps split the pro-leave the EU vote and help them when the election does come, which maybe they would like to see in November.
What is the significance of Johnson's brother, Joe Johnson, resigning as a member of parliament?
Well, I think symbolically it's just one more blow to the prime minister after a really dreadful, as you pointed out, it's a dreadful week. It's no secret that Joe Johnson and Boris Johnson do not agree on the future in the European Union. And during this questions after this thing that the prime minister was doing in front of the police, the first three questions were, if Joe Johnson doesn't believe in your Brexit plan, why should anybody else? So it puts the prime minister in a very awkward situation. But the news cycle here is going so fast that something else will pop up probably in the next day or so to supersede it.
Okay. Well, Prime Minister Johnson also expelled members of his own Conservative Party this week because they voted against him. That includes a lawmaker who is a descendant of Winston Churchill. It does seem like for Johnson, despite all that's happening, it's Brexit at any cost right now.
I think the perception among many people here and certainly his detractors, of which there are many in the Conservative Party, is that Johnson is driven by Brexit and also very much driven by personal ambition. I think that the kicking out these 21 lawmakers, one of whom, Ken Clark, had been in the party for decades.
Yeah.
You had two chancellors of the Exchequer. They're the Secretary of Treasury, the equivalent in the States, but much more important in this system. I think people were shocked by that and they saw it as really ruthless. And the way that I think they perceived it is Boris Johnson will do anything from their perspective to execute Brexit and to retain power. So, you know, I think some people thought he really overstepped here, and we'll see what happens. I mean, he's got to go out to the electorate, and he also has to make this party – he's got to bring voters in. And to throw out moderates just doesn't send that big tent message that a lot of people think he needs to send.
Is he still going to suspend parliament in a matter of days?
He is. He's going to stick with that. We just don't know which day he'll do it. He could do it, I think, as early as Monday, maybe later on in the week, Thursday, Friday, maybe Wednesday or Thursday. But yes, he will. But what's going to happen is that bill that we've been talking about this week that passed the House of Commons that would block him from taking the UK out of the EU with no deal, that will pass. He's given up on trying to stop that. And then his next move really is to try to get a date, the kind of date he wants, out of the Labour Party so that he can try to build a majority again. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have it anymore. So he can go back to Parliament and get something done.
That is NPR's Frank Langford in London, following today's news from Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who just gave a speech and said he'd rather be dead in a ditch than delay Brexit. Frank, thank you.
Happy to do it, Jeremy.
That's 91-year-old Ruby Bradley Hamill, a family friend, tuning her not always cooperative ukulele at her home in Salt Lake City, Utah. When we visited recently, she said, "I want you to record the songs we sang growing up in Malad, Idaho in the 1930s.
All my family's gone that would have ever sung them, you know. Are you ready?
Yep.
These are songs that were sung when I was growing up, and I'd always cry because they were always so sad. It was always some kind of a tragedy, you know. And it was down in the neighborhood called Suicide Alley.
Wait, but what Suicide Alley it was called?
Suicide, because the sewer ran down our street. There's no one left alive that knows it was called Suicide Alley. This is one of those songs. It's called Two Babes in the Wood. Oh, don't you remember a long time ago, two poor little babes, their names I don't know. They wandered away one bright summer day and were lost in the woods, I heard people say.
Well, that is sad. Ruby was worried that songs like this one would be lost. So when we came home, we decided to go on a musical treasure hunt. Online, we found an animated version of Babes in the Wood, in which the two little girls are replaced by little babe pigs crying in the woods, and then their tongues hanging out, just like the little girls. What? Yes, robins come and sing, but those little pigs, those little girls, they die.
Poor little babes, those poor little babes.
Well, no kidding, that's sad.
It really is.
Did you think that was to keep children from running away into the woods, maybe?
Yes, you know, you just wonder what the point was. So many of these old-time songs are so sad, but I don't know who wrote that.
Well, Cole Porter, for one. His 1924 version appeared in his 1928 show, Paris. It's based on a ballad written in England in 1595. Folklore has it based on a true story.
There's a tale of two little orphans who were left in their uncle's care.
Again, a terrible story. The uncle wants the little girl's inheritance. He takes the babes to the wood to die.
So he led them then to the forest den, where he left them to die of cold. That at least is what we're told. They were two little babes in the wood. Two little babes, oh so good. Two little hearts, two little heads, longed to be home in their two little beds.
That is so sad.
This is sad, too. And this is called The Letter and Edged in Black. I was standing by the window yesterday morning.
Now this one, you may know, recorded by Johnny Cash in 1994.
When I saw the postman coming down the pathway, he was bringing me a letter edged in black.
That letter from a father begging a son to come home.
Come home, my boy, you're dear old daddy wants you. Come home, my boy, your dear old mother's dead.
Another so sad song, sung here by Jim Reeves in 1960, but written in 1897 by Hattie Nevada, and it's a heartbreaker.
Those angry words I wish I'd never spoken. You know I didn't mean them, don't you, Jack?
May the heavens bear me witness, I am asking your forgiveness in this letter edged in black.
Killing me. I'm imagining there wasn't much else, you know, listening to
radio, you know, and my sister, my oldest sister, she'd write down the words because she could do shorthand, happier songs. But these, I don't know where these came from, but they were a tradition in the neighborhood. And this is the eastbound train. The eastbound train was crowded one cold December day.
This one goes way back, written by Lester McFarland and Robert Gardner singing here, sung by many others, including the Gibson Brothers, at the Chocolate Church in Bath, Maine in 2010.
A little girl sat in silence.
By the way, that's Joe Walsh with the Gibson Brothers. But what a story this little girl tells. Her dying father is in prison. She has no money. She's going to try to get him pardoned. The conductor is moved to tears.
He said, God bless you, little one. And just stay right where you are. You never need a ticket.
While I am on this car.
You know, it is so sad, but I'm thinking, as sad as these all are, they obviously also give you comfort. They bring you back to another time.
Right. I just, the kind of songs that I don't know if anyone ever sings them at all anymore, and whether it was just because of our area with Southern Idaho, or maybe, you know, other people have heard these songs. But to me, they're just way back in my memory, and I thought, you know, no one ever is going to hear these sad, sad songs.
All right, there's one more thing.
Yes. This was my brother Ed's favorite song. He worked with my dad a lot, and they were close. And so he always wanted me to sing this.
Is that the picture that there's a bunch of, look like teenagers, on a hay truck or something?
Well, yeah, that was my dad's. He hauled eggs to Utah Poultry down to Brigham and back. Yeah.
You know, I was thinking, too, this had to be around the time of the Depression.
Oh, yes. And, of course, then Franklin D. Roosevelt was elected, and he was my dad and my mom's idol. And this is called That Silver-Haired Daddy of Mine. In a vine-covered shack in the mountains, bravely fighting the battle of time.
Here's a dear one who's weathered life's sorrow. Is that silver-haired daddy of mine.
This search yielded a treasure trove of American music, a family tree of one great song written by the great Gene Autry, sung in his movie Tumblin' Tumbleweeds, in which he plays a traveling singing cowboy, bringing tears to the eyes of townspeople. By the way, two bully cowboys burst in and mock him and their tears. They don't want any lavender cowboy, they say. The townspeople beat them up. Pretty cool.
If I could recall all the heartaches, dear old daddy, I've caused you to pay.
It was a hit for the Everly Brothers in 1958.
If I could erase those lines from your face and bring back the gold.
It was the last song Glen Campbell sang with his late mom and dad.
If God could grant me the power just to turn back the pages of time.
And one of the first songs sung by Simon and Garfunkel.
I'd give all I own if I could put a tone to that silver-haired daddy of mine.
So I guess what we are happy to report to 91-year-old Ruby Hamill of Salt Lake City, the songs you sang growing up in Malad, Idaho, are far from lost. They've been in pretty safe hands. And I'm willing to bet if listeners bring an older loved one close to the radio right now, they will be in their hearts as well.
If I could recall all the heartaches, dear old daddy, I've called you to bear. If I could erase those lines your face and bring back the gold to your hair.
As if to prove our point, Norah Jones and Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day, wonderful. But for my money, nobody did these harmonies like the Everly Brothers. Will have all the videos at hereandnow.org.
I give my own if I could put a tone to that silver hair.
To Sharpiegate, that's what President Trump's defense of his incorrect statement about Hurricane Dorian is being called. On Sunday, the president tweeted a warning to Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, and incorrectly, Alabama. He then drilled down, saying, Dorian may get a piece of a great place. It's called Alabama. But on Sunday, it was already clear that Dorian was not going anywhere near Alabama, and his National Weather Service quickly said so. Then yesterday, in an Oval Office briefing with reporters, the president lifted up a chart of Dorian's tracking outlined in white like a tennis racket. And there was this black drawn-in spur jutting out of the end, extending the path into Alabama. Philip Bump is national reporter for The Washington Post. And Phil, social media is having a field day. Somebody extended this path with like a Sharpie.
Right.
But as you write, this isn't funny. This isn't like exaggerating the size of an inaugural crowd.
Well, I mean, in one sense, it is very much like exaggerating the size of an inaugural crowd in that it is President Trump trying to present himself as being correct in an incident when he is not correct. But obviously there are repercussions here which are different than the inaugural crowd, specifically that people who live in Alabama may have been concerned that the hurricane was headed their way. We obviously are have this sort of ingrained sense of how we respond when a hurricane is coming. You know, we ready our homes, we evacuate if necessary, that there may have been a sense in Alabama after President Trump had that tweet of, oh my gosh, this thing's coming our way, and that could have had repercussions that obviously could be quite severe.
Well, they did think that, which is why the Weather Service quickly said, no, right. It's not. And you know, you're right. It's one thing for a president to have an ego that might need to be supported no matter what it means, you know, whether or not it means people thinking a hurricane's coming when it's not. But it also dismantles the source of information. Jonathan Carl of ABC reported the claim was false. The president excoriated him on Twitter, said this was fake news. So it's at a point where a president might convince people who are in the path of danger that they're not.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so we've seen repeatedly, starting actually from that inaugural crowd, that during his presidency, President Trump has gone out of his way to cast the media as oppositional. And there are a lot of reasons that he does that, a lot of political reasons, a lot of sort of emotional reasons that he does that. But it leads to moments like this one in which we are talking about a very real and very dangerous thing, this giant hurricane, which at the time that Donald Trump tweeted was still this huge Category 5, if I remember correctly, that was, you know, potentially threatening the United States mainland, that we're debating now where this thing is going to end up simply because President Trump refuses to acknowledge that in this case – the media was obviously correct in pointing out that what he'd said was not true.
Trump was asked about the altered chart at a second White House briefing yesterday. Let's listen.
The original path that most people thought it was going to be taking, as you know, was right through Florida, where on the right would have been Georgia, Alabama, etc.
And that map that you showed today looked like it almost had like a Sharpie.
I don't know.
Look, the White House press secretary, Hogan Gidley, is tweeting the media is going ballistic over black Sharpie. It's no big deal. But others are pointing out it is a crime to alter a NOAA map. Does this just get absorbed? Phil, we only have a few seconds.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that this will sort of pass and, you know, sort of metaphorically here. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that Donald Trump went out of his way. There was someone added that black line. Trump himself uses Sharpies. Someone added that line to be able to bolster the case that Donald Trump had made about Alabama, which simply wasn't correct.
Philip Bump of The Washington Post, thank you.
On CNN last night, 10 Democrats running for president laid out their plans to address climate change. There was a lot to take in 7 hours of back-to-back town halls. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro joins us to talk about it. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
So all of the Democrats seek to decarbonize the economy in some fashion within a few decades with alternative fuels. Is there a lot of difference in their plans?
Well, there's not a ton of difference. I mean, these are Democrats who all believe that man-made climate change is real. They all believe that something needs to be done about it. They have some variations on how far they would go, and all of them pretty much think something like the Green New Deal, they either endorse parts of it or they think it's a good vision for the country. Mm-hmm. Some people would do more incremental steps, and others would do bigger things.
One of the candidates who has a pretty ambitious plan is Bernie Sanders. $16 trillion, including banning fracking and banning subsidies to fossil fuel companies. He outlined some of the ways he'd pay for it. Here he is.
We are not going to have to spend money on the military defending oil interests around the world. We can cut military spending there as well. Fourthly, our program will create up to 20 million good-paying jobs over the period of the 15 years. And when we do that, you're going to have a lot of taxpayers out there who will be paying more in taxes. You'll have people who are not getting food stamps and so forth.
So he's making the case of how he would pay for this. Tell us more about what Sanders wants to do.
You know, I thought it was interesting because Bernie Sanders, on so many issues, wants to be the boldest possible candidate, to be the clearest contrast to President Trump as possible. He got into a little bit of a controversy when he said that President Trump was an idiot because he didn't believe in climate change. He tried to clarify that last night and said that he just felt that the way he operates when it comes to climate change, the fact that he's in the White House and could rally the world around a climate change plan is, quote, idiotic. He was asked about Trump's supporters and he sort of walked a fine line and said, no, he doesn't think that applies to their supporters because the president's the one who can make all of these changes if he wanted to.
But ambitious plans from Sanders, as we heard there, Elizabeth Warren also supporting a carbon tax. That's a tax or penalty on carbon dioxide pollution. That's new for her. The idea was not in the $3 trillion plan that she debuted yesterday. Warren was asked how she would help fossil fuel industry workers in a place like Port Arthur, Texas, where a refinery is a big employer.
That's not the only job in Port Arthur over the next 20 years. I've seen Port Arthur. Port Arthur is going to need a lot of infrastructure rebuilding and strengthening. It's going to need a lot of help right on the water. Those are good jobs. Those are union jobs. Those are skilled jobs. We have a lot of work to do, and I hope the workers in Port Arthur will be a big part of that.
How does that come off, Domenico?
You know, it's funny. Elizabeth Warren has been criticized today by a lot of Republicans for, you know, these sort of attacks on her that she wants to eliminate people from eating cheeseburgers, that you want to get rid of straws. And they think that that's kind of petty and helps their case. But what Warren said to that last night was essentially, that's not the point. 70% of the pollutants come from three industries. And she said the reason people talk about these small, you know, small bore things like she's talking about with Port Arthur there, and why we should be talking bigger about it, is because you have to look at the people that she said who make the big bucks from polluting the earth.
Amy Klobuchar is a centrist from the Midwest in a state that Trump won. Sorry, in a state that had a lot of Trump voters in it. Here's what she had to say last night.
And I think you got to be honest with people about how you're going to get the money and what you're going to spend it on, or it's going to be really hard to bring along those people that we need to win in the middle of the country. We have to win the Senate. If you really want to move this, we need a different majority leader than Mitch McConnell, who's been stopping.
She does not support a ban on fracking, but does support a ban on drilling on public land. She gets a grade of C- on climate change from Greenpeace. Who does that moderate approach appeal to in a Democratic primary?
Well, it's tough in a Democratic primary, right? And, you know, we've got this next debate. I'm going to be really curious to see how Amy Klobuchar makes the case for herself because, you know, in that second round of debates, we had the moderate wing of the party sort of piling on Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. You don't have that in this debate because you've only got 10 candidates. Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar are really the only two sort of moderate Senate-like candidates. And she's arguing, look, you need to move in a direction that acknowledges climate change. It does some things to move that forward, but you can't win an election, is her argument, and bring on board the people who don't want to see such big change in such a fast way.
Let's talk about Joe Biden, the front runner in the race right now. Anderson Cooper, the host on the program, pressed Biden about a fundraiser he'd been planning to attend tonight with the co-founder of a liquid natural gas exporter, even though Biden signed a no fossil fuel money pledge. Here's that exchange.
If you're going to a fundraiser that's given in part by this guy who has a company that is pulling up natural gas, are you the right guy to go after this?
Well, I didn't realize he does that. I was told if you look at the SEC filings, he's not listed as one of those executives. That's what we look at, the SEC filings. Who are those executives? I've kept that pledge, period.
So is that, are you going to look at that fundraiser tomorrow night?
I'm going to look at what you just told me and find out if that's accurate. Yes.
Okay. I think it's pretty accurate.
The Biden campaign says the donor is not involved in day-to-day operations of the fossil fuel company. What do you make of that?
You know, it's not a good look. I mean, you've got a primary where you've got a lot of voters in Democratic politics. Climate change has now risen to be, in most polling, the second most important issue behind health care. So you talk to them, and especially young voters. There's such a generational shift where you have younger voters under 30 years old who really feel this is an urgent issue. They don't even see this as like, you know, one of the issues we have to deal with, which is kind of how some of the senators kind of talk about it in Congress. They talk about it as changing their lifestyle. Some people considering not having children because of it. You know, we saw all this stuff about hamburgers, right? And not flying. And, you know, really taking those things to heart. So when they hear of something like this, it certainly lends to why Joe Biden has this enthusiasm gap with younger voters versus the older voters who do support him.
I want to listen to one more piece of tape. This is Beto O'Rourke, who came out last night against a carbon tax in favor of a cap and trade program that would force polluters to cut emissions. And he pledged help for people in flood-prone areas, such as parts of Houston hit hard during Hurricane Harvey.
We should help people move when they need to move, when they have repaired their homes not once, not twice, but three times just in the last 5 years, because Houston, Texas, the example you gave, has witnessed three 500-year storms in 5 years. They should be good for 1,500 years, but they're not, because if we listen to the scientists, and I do, we know that those storms are going to become ever more frequent.
You know, Domenico, on the issue of guns, we talk a lot about how there are so many people now in this country who've been directly affected by mass shootings. Are we in the same situation with climate change, where people have had direct experience with very severe storms that they're not used to, and that is going to drive them to vote in the way that O'Rourke is appealing to there?
yes to the first part of your question, it's not clear to the second part whether there'll actually be a voting issue for them, because I think that there are a lot of people who are impacted by climate change. You think about some of these 100-year storms, as Beto O'Rourke puts out there. You think about the Mississippi River overflowing and flooding some of those riverside communities that have been there for centuries. And a whole host of other things when it comes to the severity of storms, wildfires in California, the more prevalence of a lot of these things. The question is whether or not people in those communities believe it's definitely linked to climate change or not, even though it is. And what makes the threshold change for them to not say that they have to recover and want more money to be able to live in the same place? Or are people going to start migrating?
I just want to ask you one more thing. You know, we heard a lot of ambitious proposals last night. I remember that President Obama tried to pass cap and trade legislation when he had control of both houses of Congress in his first term, and he couldn't do it. Do any of these plans stand a chance?
He certainly tried to pass a cap and trade bill. It wound up putting a lot of actually Democrats in the House at risk. You remember Joe Manchin when he ran for re-election in West Virginia? He shot a bullet through the cap and trade bill. That was part of his advertising plan. So the problem with a lot of these plans is they're not going to get through Congress. And so much of it is aspirational, though, that they want to be able to put it out and say this is their vision.
Domenico Montanaro, senior political editor and correspondent for NPR. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
There's been an offshore wind stampede along the East Coast in recent years, and thankfully we're not talking about hurricanes. Off the coast of Massachusetts, the Vineyard Wind Project is working to build the country's first large-scale offshore wind farm. But the region's commercial fishermen say the offshore wind industry is growing too fast, too soon. One of their major concerns, the impact of wind farms on their safety. Nadine Sabai has more.
On most days, Daniel Farnham is on the dock of his father's fishing boat, working alongside his crew that catches squid, whiting, and porgy off the coast of New Bedford, Massachusetts. But on this day, the 100-foot boat is out of the water. Farnham is wearing a hard hat, protective glasses, and a safety jacket, conducting the boat's biennial maintenance check. He's been working on this vessel for over 4 years and says nature's elements aren't kind to the boat or fishermen.
My first real commercial trip was hurricane force winds and 20-foot waves at the end of it. And we just kept working until the end, filled up the boat, and then worked our way in. But those are the conditions we operate in, because these boats are meant to go out and work.
Fishing is one of the most dangerous jobs in the country.
It's like trying to drive around in a car with no brakes on a road that can be moving in any direction, like a road made out of treadmills, basically, and then having obstacles thrown in your way continuously.
Farnham says offshore wind farms will make it worse. That's because fishermen argue the turbines aren't spaced far enough apart to allow vessels to safely navigate through them. The plan is to install 84 massive turbines in a grid-like pattern, about 3/4 to a nautical mile apart. Farnham says mobile gear vessels like his that have massive nets trawling behind them will make it even harder to navigate.
The currents and the tide just take you in whatever direction they're going. And so that's when you could wind up having a collision or an elision with one of the turbines or another vessel within the array, because everyone's maneuverability is a lot more limited.
Farnham is part of a fisheries working group. He's hoping that safety will be addressed before the project is a done deal. Fishermen in the group want the turbines to be spaced farther apart or closer together so the wind farm takes up less space and the boats can navigate around them. If that doesn't work, fishermen want to be compensated more for potential safety losses. Environmental economist Tom Sproul says there are reasons to be concerned about safety. Sproul evaluates risk, and his work has recently focused on the fishing industry. In May, Sproul wrote a letter to Massachusetts coastal zone management officials. He provided them with some rough economic calculations about the number of accidents they could expect for Rhode Island and Massachusetts fishermen once the Vineyard Wind Farm is in operation.
On average, there will be 3 accidents over 30 years for the Massachusetts fishermen, and about five for Rhode Island fishermen. We're talking about eight accidents that randomly happen over 30 years over thousands of fishermen. It could just as easily be 16 over that 30-year stretch, and it would not be statistically remarkable. It could be fewer as well. But the point is that if any one of these does happen, we start talking about much larger costs.
An accident involving a loss of a vessel could cost anywhere between $700,000 to $8 million per incident. That's not including loss of income for the fishermen or the cost of human life. Sproul says the number of accidents will depend on how fishermen react once the turbines are actually in the water.
These things are complex. We don't know what's going to happen. There are supposedly safety channels going to be in between some of the turbine fields. It's not known at this time whether those channels are wide enough to provide meaningful safety.
Vineyard Wind says it did its homework early on in the design process. It held over 100 meetings with fishermen or fishing organizations that worked the waters in or around the wind farm area. And it analyzed vessel traffic data to find patterns in how fishermen operate. Eric Stevens is Chief Development Officer for Vineyard Wind.
We did have a navigational risk assessment done by a globally renowned company who does these kind of assessments, and including taking into account experience and lessons from the UK or other parts of the world. And their determination was that it would allow for safe navigation.
The Interior Department ordered further analysis of the project's impact on commercial fishing, as well as a study of the industry's cumulative impacts on the environment. It's expected the analysis will be completed late this year or early next year. And the U.S. Coast Guard is evaluating Vineyard Wind's risk assessment and is working on its own assessment of what measures can maximize safe navigation within offshore wind farms. Stevens welcomes the scrutiny.
It's in our interest as developing this first project to make sure that everything that we've been saying proves to be true.
Whatever happens here has the potential to affect not just Vineyard Wind, but the 15 active projects in the works across the Northeast, which is why Farnham says getting it right the first time matters.
It terrifies me to picture trying to drive through a forest of thousands of turbines, which is, if every state's offshore wind energy mandate comes to fruition, then that's what it will be, several thousand wind turbines offshore that we try and work through.
He knows he'll have to get used to working within wind turbines his entire career, but in the end, he may just do his best to avoid them. For Here and Now, I'm Nadine Sabai.
And Nadine's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.